So I'm going to talk about turbulence when you cannot neglect magnetic fields, when magnetic fields are strong and in fact forming the turbulent dynamics. So this work is done. Yeah, I'm not going to discuss star formation. I'm just going to concentrate on the properties of this turbulence. So this work is done in collaboration with. So this is our group. Collaboration Jean. Jean and Joanna are postdocs in Chicago in medicine and Faust Economics in Chicago. So first of all, why energy turbulence is important? So, the known example is a solar wind, where magnetic and velocity fluctuations can be directly measured. And in the solar wind, people observe a large spectrum of long spectrum of fluctuations, which covers about three or four orders of magnitude. So. The problem is how to explain these fluctuations, and this problem is related to the problem of solar wind heating. So if we assume that plasma is propagating from the sun, and as it expands, it cools down adiabatically, and we try to derive the law, how temperature changes with the radius, this law is different from the observed law, which means that a solar wind should be heated while it propagates from the sun. So, and for example, if we know the temperature of the solar wind at about one astronomical unit, and we would like to find the temperature at, say, 70 astronomical units, the adiabatic expansion will give us an estimate which is about from 10 to 100 times smaller than it's measured. So it's indeed important to understand how it's heated, and some theories suggest that this heating actually is consistent with the turbulent heating. So the second example is the interstellar.
Yeah. So the turbulence also being adiabatically expanded. So
yes. 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 So this expansion happens very fast. So and there was a theory when you expand turbulence and solar wind simultaneously. So there was a suggestion that as the gas magnetic field drops, ion Larmor radius becomes larger and larger, and ion Larmor radius is the scale where dissipation occurs. So in somehow the dissipation scale becomes larger and larger and larger, and slowly it eats all this turbulence which is present in the solar wind. So is it, what was the question? So reconnection is actually part of turbulence. So when you have magnetic turbulence, that energy dissipates due to reconnection as well. So so if you have turbulence, but there is no if you have some frozen fluctuations of velocity and magnetic field, it do not provide means of dissipation, then you won't heat the plasma. So you need a way to extract energy from fluid motion into thermal motion. And if you have turbulent cascade, it can provide this mechanism.
So you're saying that the heating is just a negligible fraction of this energy?
No. Yeah.
Because if the heating were significant, that is, in normal interstellar like molecular clouds, we think that most of the energy goes into radiation. Mm-hmm. But it's just being. I take all the energy and in the crossing time, it gets dissipated. Here you have many crossing times. Essentially, you're going from 1 AU to 7 AU.
Right.
Really expanding, doing the adiabatic expansion. So the amplitude of everything is going down. In addition to the damping, it's also just kind of starving it.
Right. So, but we can ask how much energy goes into heat. So, if you have turbulent energy, it doesn't mean that ask how much energy goes into heat. And if we say that no turbulent energy goes into heat, we would underestimate the temperature of the solar wind. So, we really need some turbulent cascade. If we just have some large scale fluctuations of magnetic and velocity field without turbulent cascade, that would be insufficient to heat the solar wind. So, this is. So, and the second interesting example is the interstellar density fluctuations in the interstellar medium. So these density fluctuations exist at also in a broad range of scale, and most important are those small scales which are below the iron mean free path in the interstellar medium. And it would be hard to imagine how we can create density fluctuations at such short scales. But if we assume that the interstellar medium is magnetized, then we have to compare these density fluctuation scales not with the mean free path, but with the Einler-Mohr radius, which is much, much smaller. So in the perpendicular direction, the plasma is confined to these magnetic field lines, and therefore if you create some density structure, the density structure will not diffuse due to mean free path, due to streaming of particles. So now I would like to explain how MHG turbulence is different from the hydrodynamic turbulence. So hydrodynamic turbulence can be thought of as consisting of eddies, fluctuations of fluid velocity. So suppose that we have some large-scale eddy, and this eddy becomes unstable on about one turnover time, and its energy goes into smaller-scale eddies. And each of these smaller-scale eddies then becomes unstable again and creates even smaller-scale eddies and so on, and that's how energy goes to smaller and smaller scales, and finally it's removed from the system by viscosity, goes into heat. So, and these eddies which live on inside of this large-scale eddy do not know anything about the large-scale eddy. They're just advected by large-scale eddy and then dissipate energy due to fragmentation and so on. So, in the MHG turbulence, even if we start with a very weak magnetic field and go to smaller and smaller scales, magnetic field is always important. It cannot be so. Even if we look at smaller scale eddies in magnetic field, the small scale eddy also always feels the magnetic field which is created by the large scale eddy. So magnetic field is always present. One can, in other words, one can say that a magnetic field cannot be removed by going into moving frame. So here, if we go into the frame which moves with this large-scale eddy, we won't feel this large-scale eddy due to Galilean transform. But we just go to other inertial frame. So here, by going into, say, a frame moving with this eddy, we cannot remove magnetic field. So all eddies which are created inside this eddy will also feel the same strong magnetic field.
If you had large-scale shear, would that affect this argument?
So if we have large-scale shear, we have to compare it with the shear which is created in these small-scale fluctuations. And it turns out that as you go to smaller and smaller scales, the shear in these fluctuations becomes larger and larger. So a large-scale shear becomes less and less important as you go to smaller and smaller scales. But a large-scale magnetic field cannot be removed. You cannot, if you go to a moving frame, you cannot remove magnetic field. So in MHG turbulence, we can... So in this picture, magnetic field should... So from numerical simulations, we know that this structure of turbulence changes when guide field is about maybe from 3 to 5 times stronger than the RMS fluctuations at these scales. So if you look at the small scale fluctuations, if magnetic field is about 5 times stronger, you are already in the regime of strong magnetic field. So, but from 3 to 5. So then MHG turbulence can be thought of interaction of wave packets that propagate along the guide field. And it can be argued, it can be shown that only waves moving in opposite direction interacts with each other. So this wave packet will be deformed, this eddy will be deformed and create smaller scale eddies inside it, only when it collides with an oppositely moving wave packet. So this is the basic idea. So now why... So are there any other situation when the strong guide field is relevant? And yes, of course, there are such situations in a laboratory plasma. So this is, for example, the medicine experiment where magnetic fields are magnetic field is directed along this torus, and it also there is also this it winds up around these different surfaces. So and these are fluctuations of magnetic fields plotted versus toroidal mode, which is just scale. So this is actually a magnetic fluctuation, spectrum of magnetic fluctuations. And indeed, one can observe some spectra which resemble spectra of MHG turbulence if we assume that there is some turbulent cascade. And this is actually, this question is under investigation now, and it seems that indeed turbulence in this range has the features of MHG turbulent cascade. So, and of course, in all laboratory applications, magnetic field is strong because this is the way how you confine plasmas. So otherwise, you simply cannot do such experiments. So, in other experiments with which we are collaborating now is in UCLA. It's called LAPD, Large Plasma Device Experiment, where it's actually a long chamber, 18 meters long, where you have a long, strong magnetic field. And we need such a long device because if you want to excite Alvian wave, which is very long, which has very long wavelengths, so you really need, so along this device, which is 18 meters long, Alvian wave has about 5 meter, from I think 3 to 5 meter wavelengths. So this turbulence is actually turbulence fluctuations, since magnetic field is very strong, are basically shuffling magnetic field lines, and these are particles which are magnetized plasma particles. So so now a little bit of math. I just want to show the equations which we are solving. So these are MHG equations. They're written in slightly not so common form, in Ilsasser variables. So this is just a momentum equation and induction equation, so for the velocity field and for the magnetic field. And these equations become very symmetric if we, instead of V and B, we use the so-called Ilsasser variables, V plus B and V minus B, and we separated the guide field B naught. So this is the guide field, and these are delta V and delta B. So, and indeed, these equations immediately tell us that if we create a configuration where W is zero, where V is equal to minus B everywhere, then nonlinear term here drops out, and then the solution of this equation is just linearly propagating wave packet. So if W is zero, then the wave packet propagates along the guide field in one direction. If we create a wave packet where V is equal to B everywhere, V and B are just the same, then this wave packet will propagate to the left. And since in each of these cases equations are linear, there is no interaction. And we have interaction only when these wave packets collide. So when they collide, what happens is that energy inside of each of these wave packets does not change. So when this wave packet after collision becomes here, finds itself here, its energy is the same inside this wave packet. But this wave packet is, and same is true for this wave packet. But each of these wave packets is now deformed. So when it's deformed, we can say that energy goes from large scales to smaller scales. And that's how energy cascades. So it just moves along the magnetic field lines, it collides with oppositely moving eddies, and it deforms, and it creates smaller and smaller structures. And that's how energy cascades to smaller and smaller scales. Okay, so, and now we can consider, yeah? So energy goes to small scales, always goes to small scales. No, so if we look at energy, so energy wave packet will always be deformed in such a way as energy goes to small, I mean statistically, energy goes to small scales. But there are some quantities which go to large scales, for example, magnetic helicity. If you create some twisted magnetic field lines, it will try to unwind and go to larger and larger and larger scales. And that's this is a mechanism how magnetic fields are this is a mechanism which people use to explain magnetic fields, large-scale magnetic fields, which are, for example, created in galaxies. Because velocity fluctuations in galaxies, for example, in our galaxy, typical scale of velocity fluctuations is about 100 parsec. But there are large-scale magnetic fields which are correlated in about 1,000 parsec scale. So, that's how nonlinear dynamics works in this equation. And also, one can say that there is a sink of energy at small scales. So energy is always extracted from small scales. And it has to be replenished by nonlinear interaction. But energy is not extracted at large scales. So if you create some distribution of energy, it will go to smaller scales. To actually answer this question, one has to analyze this nonlinear term, because there are situations when actually energy goes to larger scales, yes, in two-dimensional turbulence. So in three-dimensional MHG, energy goes to small scales. Energy cascades to small scales.
But even if you did have the inverse cascade in the presence of magnetic helicity, there would be some energy going to the large scales.
Right.
still be energy going to small.
Yeah, there will be some energy, but there will be no cascade. If we ask how much energy goes through each scale, if we go to larger and larger scales, we will see that less and less amount of energy goes through this scale. But if you had a cascade, you would have the same amount of energy, which goes through all scales. So you can put some energy at large scales, but if you ask how much energy you put at large and larger scales, it will be smaller and smaller and smaller amount of energy at increased scale. Okay, so now one can consider weak turbulence and strong turbulence. It actually, weak turbulence means that we have, so if we look at these equations, we can compare linear term and nonlinear term, right? Linear term includes gradients of this z of fluctuations along the guide field, because VLVN is along the guide field, right? And nonlinear term includes gradients in all possible directions, but the largest gradients are in the field perpendicular direction. So, if linear term is much larger than the nonlinear one, we practically have waves which just propagate along the guide field, practically without any interaction. If the nonlinear term becomes comparable to the linear term, we have strong interaction. So, only one propagation is enough, only one collision is enough to deform wave packets. So, then this can be shown schematically in the following way. Weak turbulence means that wave packets are very short in the field parallel direction. So their gradients are very large in the field parallel direction. K parallel VLVN, or frequency associated with this wave packet, is very large. So these wave packets, when they collide, these wave packets will have to collide with very many wave packets moving in the opposite direction before it gets distorted. But if we have eddies which are elongated along the large scale field, then such eddies collide during very long time because they're long. And therefore, it will be enough to have only one collision to deform each eddy. So it doesn't matter. So there are different pictures of strong turbulence. But every time when we speak about strong turbulence, we assume that eddies are stretched along the guide field. So only one collision is enough. So, and this is explained here. So, if we assume that some typical scale of the wave packet in the field parallel direction is L, this is a scale in the field perpendicular direction, then we estimate this term as VLVN divided by L multiplied by some fluctuation. And this scale is fluctuation divided by this scale, the perpendicular scale. So, turbulence becomes strong when these two terms are the same. And if we know how delta B scales with lambda, we can see how L scales with lambda. And but in any case, since fluctuations are much smaller than VLVN, L is much larger than lambda, and this condition is called the critical balance by Goldreich and Sridhar. So, which means that when turbulence is critically balanced, it means that it's at each scale always linear term is of the same order as the nonlinear one. They always balance in each other. And this actually explains why eddies should be stretched along the guide field. So now, as I mentioned, there are two. So this picture appeared in 1995. This picture appeared later and basically was motivated by numerical simulations. So in this picture, only one interaction time is enough to transfer energy. And this is very similar to the Kolmogorov picture, because the Kolmogorov picture, also one turnover time is enough to transfer energy to the smaller scales. This is actually the time of energy cascade, just eddy turnover time. So in this theory, predict the spectrum. If we ask what is the spectrum of turbulence, we can measure the spectrum versus K-perp. And the spectrum turns out to be K-perp to minus 5/3. Now, and indeed, early numerical simulations suggested that this is correct, and spectrum is indeed minus 5/3. But recent numerical simulations, I mean recent, starting from about 2000, and we already have about three independent, we have at least three independent groups which observe the spectrum, suggest that spectrum is minus 3/2. So turbulence is indeed is strong, eddies are elongated along the guide field, but spectrum is minus 3/2. And it can be explained by this flattening of eddies in the field perpendicular direction. So in fact, eddies do not look like cigars or filaments, but they look like these ribbons, which these two ribbons sit inside larger ribbon, and as they interact, the interaction is reduced because fluctuations of velocity and magnetic fields are aligned. But it's not now relevant. So what I would like to stress here is that so why in early numerical simulations we couldn't see spectrum minus 3/2? Because actually numerical simulations sometimes were done with not so strong guide field. About magnetic field was about of the same order as the RMS value of fluctuations. And now we know that guide field should be strong. Then simulations were done in a cubic box. And we know that because edges are elongated, you also need to take a simulation box which is also elongated along the guide field to make sure that edges actually fit into this box. So because of periodic boundary conditions, you can just shortcut this eddy by itself if you don't have long simulation box. And numerical resolution in the field perpendicular direction should be large, because when eddies interact, they become magnetic field lines become distorted in the field perpendicular direction, and all the dynamics happens in the field perpendicular direction. So if these three ingredients in numerical simulations are satisfied, then the spectrum is minus 3/2. And,
While you were talking about solar wind, showing how the observations show that a gamma 1/5 simply doesn't match observations, you can try to see the observation written by kind of adjusted gamma factor. Would that correlate with the exponents you make here?
So 5/3 and 3/2 are very close to each other, and so solar wind observations, even when it is claimed that the spectrum of minus 3/2, you can just look at these papers and this data, and you can also fit it with minus.
I was thinking that
No, because those are small scales, and Alvenic waves actually do not feel. You can have a large pressure plasma, small pressure plasma. They don't feel this because Alvenic fluctuations are incompressible. It's just shuffling of magnetic field lines. We don't compress plasma, so it doesn't matter what gamma factor is. It's small scales.
Guide field does not necessarily, I would suggest, need to be uniform. It can perhaps also be a turbulent one. So the magnetic field at larger scales, if it follows a cascade, will affect any magnetic field at smaller scales as well. And so if you talk about guide field, that can be a very turbulent field.
Right. So as we know, in turbulence, large-scale eddies has larger velocities. They're stronger. And they create stronger magnetic field. And therefore, if we go to small and smaller scales and look at the small and small eddies which sit on top of these large scale eddies, these small scale eddies will also feel this strong magnetic field. So smaller scale eddies feel magnetic fields created by larger scale eddies. So that's why we believe that it's not.
If you do a series of simulations with differently stretched boxes, say 10 different simulations, how would the power index change?
So the first simulations which show minus 3/2 were done by Maron and Goldreich in 2000, and they have also a stretched box and a very strong magnetic field. I don't remember how large the box was.
But the question is, if you just gradually strain.
Right. So.
Leading to everything else.
So these simulations by Müller and Grappin had actually cubic box, but they have really really large resolution in the curve direction. It was cubic box. Spectrum was minus 3/2. In our simulations, we have a box which is 5 times longer in one direction. The spectrum doesn't change. It's also 3/2. So it seems to be once you have large enough. So there are two ways to get to smaller eddies. Either to have very long inertial interval, then it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Or start with an elongated box and fit all the eddies from the beginning. What was another question?
I was wondering if you can actually observe these eddies in the simulations. Can one see that they're long and slender, or that little cylinders like this?
Right. It's possible. Yeah, I will show some. Yeah, it's possible to see that actually. I will mention it later that in energy turbulence, in hydrodynamic turbulence, we know that energy dissipates in vortices, right? So if we go to small and small and smaller scales, we finally your turbulence structure is just a vortex which dissipates all the energy. In energy turbulence, we know that as we go to small and smaller scales, we converge to current sheets. We dissipate energy in current sheets, not in filaments. And so these current sheets are actually very consistent with such flipping of eddies. And I will show simulations.
In energy spectrum, spectrum, does this include both the electromagnetic and the magnetic?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, total energy. There is a slight difference, but when you have total, because total energy cascades, not separate magnetic velocity, then you have this spectrum. Or if you have very large resolution, they should become the same. So these are numerical simulations, 512 cubed, that's how they look like, and we also have simulations 1024 in the perpendicular direction, and they don't show any difference. So you can see what is the quality of simulations. I mean, how we can, so indeed, 3/2 fits better than 5/3. Okay, and this is this is a question how these edges look like. This is a cross section of the simulation domain where magnetic field fluctuations are large, and these large strong magnetic fluctuations are caused by strong shear. And when it sees that they look more like filaments, and if you try to play. So this is magnetic. These are fluctuations of magnetic field in the field perpendicular direction, and this is the strength of these fluctuations. So one can say that if you have, you can stretch magnetic field in this direction if you have strong shearing flow. So in some sense, it shows you the strongest shear, the largest shear. So. So in this box is elongated along the z direction. So in, it looks like if we just see how this box looks like. So it's in it stretched very much. It is stretched very much along the z axis. This is real size of the simulation box, and these are very short in this direction. So you can from this cross sections you can judge that it's actually.
How do you ensure that the difference, the energy difference?
So we drive it in such a way that our force, the largest eddy which we drive, is already in critically balanced. So it's linear, its scale in the field parallel perpendicular direction is such that linear term is equal to nonlinear term is in image equations.
When you solve it, you say you use 500 cubes, and the individual cell itself is also
longer than the line. Yeah, each cell is longer, yeah. Because there is no then edges are stretched along the guide field, so you don't need as large resolution along the field in the perpendicular direction. One can also check the convergence. One can check, say, start from 512, go to 256, 128, and you don't see any difference in the field perpendicular spectrum. Okay, so now why this flattened edges indeed reduce? And it lead to different spectrum. So this is, if you look at the plane which is perpendicular to the guide field, this is a cross section of edges. And if we have edges which are shortened in this direction and fluctuations are in this direction, so fluctuations V and B fluctuate in this direction, but gradients are in this direction, perpendicular direction. So this velocity and magnetic fields look like that. Now if you calculate the nonlinear term, Z and W are in this direction, but their gradients are in the perpendicular direction. Then field multiplied by the gradient, this scalar product is reduced by this interaction angle, by this angle of alignment. And that's why a nonlinear interaction is depleted, and therefore interaction time increases and it changes spectrum. Basically how it works. Okay, so and now how these edges look like. So this is a magnetic field structure in the Goldreich-Schrittfer eddy. It would have the same scales in the directions perpendicular to the guide field. So as and this is eddy which has this alignment which is flattened. So as the scale of the fluctuation decreases, this eddy turns into filament, right? Because it's just contracting those guys. But this eddy turns into a current sheet, which is what we, which is more consistent with observations. And now about a few words about weak turbulence. So in original Eroshnikov-Krechtin picture, this picture actually implied weak turbulence, wave packets which interact many times before they are deformed, and the spectrum that was predicted was -3/2 in this weak turbulence theory. But then. And the spectrum was supposed to be isotropic in -3/2. But then it was found that the spectrum is in fact strongly inisotropic. And maybe it's better to maybe I'll just say that since this turbulence is weak, we have waves which interact only slightly. One can mathematically derive what the spectrum should be if you have weak turbulence, because you can expand in the interaction and in average over statistical ensemble and find what the spectrum should be. And when you derive these equations, which were derived by Gaultier et al. In 2000, and try to see which eddies interact with which, you immediately observe that eddy propagates in one direction does not interact with eddy of the same size, which propagates in the opposite direction. There's no interaction between these two eddies. In fact, this eddy interacts with very, very long, which strongly, with strongly elongated eddy. So in the original picture, it was assumed that eddies of the same size interact, like an incompressible turbulence, eddies of typical.
If you assume that you have
you get the spectrum. No, if you assume this and try to see whether it is supported by the equations, it is not. So equations show that those two eddies will not interact. Will not interact in the first.
Yes,
so the. Yeah, the dominant interaction comes from interaction of this short eddy with very elongated eddy. And we're back in the spectrum. If you calculate these interactions, spectrum is k perp to minus 2, not minus 3.
What I don't understand is that it seems that you need to have elongated eddies to explain the interaction.
Right.
So if you have elongated eddies, the predominant interaction will be between elongated eddies, as you explained us in the case of strong.
So in weak turbulence theory, when you assume that interaction is small, so you can show that dominant interaction is all the eddies of all sizes which you can have here will interact predominantly with the very, very, with the longest eddies possible in this system.
But this question is, do we actually have the non-elongated eddies, the spherical eddies, do we have those?
Yeah, of course, you can create waves, for example, very, very, very short waves, very large k parallel in this direction, and see with what structures this wave will interact. And you will see that these waves will interact with waves whose frequency is very, very low, only with this long eddies. They will not interact with high frequency eddies.
Distribution of size.
You have all possible sizes, but all sizes, all short eddies will interact with the same long eddies. And we're again back to the same problem as we had before. To simulate weak turbulence, we again need to make sure that those long eddies, which should be critically balanced, because it's just weak turbulence doesn't work precisely when this eddy becomes critically balanced. So when this eddy again fits into the simulation box, so again you need very, very elongated box to simulate weak turbulence.
But if you have an elongated eddy, don't you expect that you will stretch the line and make the field stronger?
When I say elongated eddy, these eddies do not stretch the lines. You have lines and you just shuffle them. So it means that
you don't stretch.
No, you shuffle them. So you mean that wave, it's long. You shuffle them. And this wave will provide the dominant contribution to the interaction. So all these short scale eddies, all these waves with large frequencies will scatter by these low frequency waves. And if we do not resolve these low frequency waves, we do not resolve weak turbulence. We cannot simulate weak turbulence. So once again, we need to have long, strong guide field. We need to have simulation box which is stretched along the guide field, and we need to have numerical simulations with enough resolution in the field perpendicular direction. So weak turbulence theory does not confirm this spectrum, but it does confirm the k2 minus 2 spectrum. And this is the picture. This is how numerical simulations are basically set up. So this is k perp and k perpendicular plane. So k perp is actually modulus of k perp vector versus a guide field. So we create we have some forcing which acts at small k parallel and k perp, right? And if this width in this direction and this direction are the same and guide field is strong, then first of all waves have very large, very high frequencies, so then linear terms will be much larger than the nonlinear terms. And we will have a weak turbulence cascade first. And weak turbulence cascade proceeds, it can also be shown, in the field perpendicular direction. So energy in this K-perp, K-parallel plane will flow in the K-perpendicular direction. Just without broadening and k-parallel direction. And spectrum going to be k-perp to minus 2. But then, as k-perp increases and k-parallel doesn't change, this term doesn't change because k-parallel doesn't change, but k-perp increases, so stronger and stronger gradients are developed here, and sooner or later nonlinear terms become important and turbulence becomes strong. And when it becomes strong, the general picture is the following. First, if you start with some force, first you see weak turbulence cascade, and spectrum is k to minus 2. Then turbulence becomes strong, and the spectrum starts to broaden in the field parallel direction. And the spectrum becomes, if you integrate over all these lines and just compute k-perp spectrum, is going to be minus 3 halves. Yeah. So we check this numerically. By forcing, so this is k parallel k perp plane. So if we force, if our force creates velocity fluctuations such that the linear frequencies k parallel multiplied by VLVN is very large, much larger than the nonlinear term, then energy indeed cascades in the field perpendicular direction. Energy cascade goes in this direction. But now, as we force with smaller and smaller, with force which excites low and low frequency waves, sooner or later we get into the critical balance regime. That's the question, how we force turbulence. So we already, from the beginning, we are already in a critically balanced regime. And then energy goes not only in the parallel direction, but not only in the perp direction, but also in parallel direction, so that critical balance condition is preserved at each scale. And the spectrum indeed changes. So in this case, when we have weak turbulence, spectrum is very close to k to minus 2. But then as turbulence becomes stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, spectrum becomes flatter and flatter, and finally approaches minus 3 halves. And there is no special point which would correspond to 5 thirds on this plot. At least in our simulations, we couldn't see it.
If you don't know whether there is a strong magnetic field or not, if you obtain a slope of 2, does the slope of 2 also describe Berger's SV turbulence?
Yes.
So you could completely miss the thing with only the slope of the quartet.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so there are other cases when spectrum is minus 2, yeah. But what is good about MHC turbulence, as you go to larger and larger k-perp, spectrum should change from minus 2 to 3 halves, to become flat. And this is how spectrum changes with this width of the forcing.
What is the limiting spectrum of k-perp, you know, around 1 or 2?
Here?
The upper one. Is that where you're forcing your upper right spectrum? Over that?
Here?
Upper right.
On the right.
This one?
Yeah, now the peak.
Oh, so this is actually our forcing. We force at k equal 1, k equal 2. Okay. So this is our forcing, and there is some transition region, and then this is inertial interval.
Don't have quite exactly.
No, so unfortunately. So this is 512. In 128, you see more. So the spectrum actually, if you go to 256, 512, 128, spectrum just becomes longer and longer and longer. You don't see any features on it. Okay, and this the question is whether there are numerical observations where the spectrum is 3 halves. And so this is a structure function of density fluctuations from pulsar observations, and the slope of the second order structure function, energy spectrum is minus 1 minus this slope. So there are indeed some observations which are more consistent with minus 3 halves. So these are solar wind observations, and it's so 3 halves may fit slightly better here than 5 thirds, but these are not the raw spectra. These are spectra which are obtained from some wavelet with some wavelet transformation procedure. So there are some observational puzzles which we still don't understand. So these are from a recent paper by John Podesta and Robertson Goldstein. And they claim that if you measure magnetic field spectrum, it's minus 1, it's close to 5 thirds. But if you measure velocity field spectrum, it fits, it follows very nicely minus 3 halves. And we still don't understand why this happens. But of course, solar wind is compressible. It's not uniform. It's inhomogeneous. So maybe some other effects which.
Do you know whether velocity drives the profit or not?
So they actually don't know, because what they measure, there is just they use this frozen-in hypothesis. So they have satellite and solar just passes by, and they just measure time series, and then they measure velocity at all times. And velocity, of course, changes, and they don't know how isotropical this region, because you cannot, we don't have other.
That's what you'd expect. You expect equal partition between the perpendicular velocity and the fluctuation velocity and fluctuation.
Yeah. Those both are fluctuations.
Have the same power loss factor. It could be the other parts of velocity.
Maybe. So they don't know the reason either, yeah. So.
The kinetic energy is much stronger, actually. It's two orders of magnitude stronger. That seems correct. Is it just the solar wind?
Is it stronger? So it's some.
Oh, they're different units.
Yeah, it's different, yeah. It's measured in nanoteslas and kilometers per second. So yeah, it's not Alvenic. Yeah, but if it was the total spectrum of magnetic plus kinetic, it turns out to be somewhere in between, 1.57, something 1.55. Okay, and so conclusion. So we hope that we resolve this controversy among numerical simulations. So we say that if you want to simulate either weak or strong turbulence, it doesn't matter. We need to make sure that elongated eddies fit into our simulation box. And this spectra of turbulence, in strong turbulence, so in numerical simulations we see that it's close to -3/2, and weak turbulence is close to -2, and we have some analytical explanation for those spectra, and this is broadly consistent with observations. Thank you. So we do kind of one step at a time. So we want, so possibly next step would be to generalize it to try to understand. So if we have some weak compressibility, what happens to such a spectrum? I don't have any results.
So this is for the second order structure function.
This is for what?
That's for the power spectrum. Mm-hmm. And is there any theory for the structure function of any other order? Component of the structure function for this.
So second order structure function should be derived from the spectrum, right? And there are numerical measurements of high order structure functions by Mueller and Biscamp. And they indeed show that it follows some Shane-Levesque intermittency theory. Yeah.
So the Miller-Biscamp model is behind scaling of Miller-Biscamp is behind that.
Yeah, it's high order structure functions.
But then, which one? Because you have either -3/2 or -2.
For strong, I think, yeah. Oh, yeah, I think it's for strong, yeah. For the end of the picture balloon. With imposed field, with strong guide field. I think it was about five times stronger than the RMS fluctuations.
I should maybe say that the simulations by Haldon et al. Without a guide field.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we know this paper. By Hagen, Brandenburg, and Dobler. It was in 2003, right? And yeah, we actually looked at this paper, and in my opinion, it was possibly the first observation of -3/2 spectrum in isotropic MG turbulence. You have very long inertial interval, about 1,028.24 cubed. So it made it. We didn't actually notice this paper before because it actually claimed that maybe this spectrum is due to bottleneck effect. It's not really physical, but it's just artifact of low numerical resolution. But in our numerical simulations, we don't see this bottleneck effect. When we increase the resolution, spectrum just continues without any features. So yeah, maybe there is also another paper which appeared maybe half a year ago, maybe a few months ago, by Menini and Pouquet. They also do isotropic symmetry turbulence, and they also observe spectrum k2 minus 3 halves.
So here, these are the only way we have to distinguish between both between weak and strong emission turbulence, or is there any observable that would allow us to distinguish between weak and strong? I mean, for instance, comparing.
I know that in the solar wind, I think sometimes it's possible to measure the spectrum of fluctuations along the guide field and across the guide field, k parallel and k perp. And if you can, you see that the spectrum is quite wide in the k parallel, you can say the turbulence is in a weak regime. Because in a solar wind, when you have a solar wind which is passing by, magnetic field, guide field changes, and in some cases you can actually observe when. You have a case when magnetic field is along the observation, along the line of motion, sometimes it's perpendicular, so you can measure k parallel and k perp and can compare them. Yeah, so in this case you can, but if you cannot.
In terms of the restriction of only the velocity, do you expect differences for the spectrum of the velocity and the
magnetic field? No, they are the same in both series. Okay. Yeah, in both cases they're the same.
Started your talk by noting that still the energy source that you said was from turbulence.
Yeah.
Okay. So mm-hmm. These models help
interpret
that data now.
So if you assume, so in Kolmogorov theory, you can you know how much energy is dissipated. If you know the energy spectrum, you know the viscosity. You can say how much energy goes into heat. Viscosity is not even important, just energy cascade. So it turns out, if you look at the Kolmogorov theory, it would overestimate the heat. It would overestimate it. I learned it just recently at this APS meeting of plasma physics meeting from John Podesta. He actually told me that if you assume that there is this reduction of nonlinear interaction, which leads to k2 minus 3 halves, then it agrees with observations. So if you have interaction time which is slightly longer, so you deposit energy not so fast, then it agrees with observations.
Okay, why don't we thank you.
Thank you.